I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. If you've been lucky enough to buy your first home, or maybe even something like an investment property, there are two things that happen quite quickly. First is the excitement of doing a big money move for your future. But second is the mild panic that can occur when you see several hundred thousand dollars of mortgage debt turning up in your bank account. There are lots of gurus out there who'll try to sell you mortgage hacks by preying on this feeling. So what's actually good and what's not? Well, I found someone who's working in the financial industry and has a long history as a property investor that can guide us through it all. So let's find out. All right, welcome in Dan Bell, financial advisor and co-founder of Collab Mortgages, which is this really exciting new venture you've got going. And we'll jump into that soon because it is interesting what you're doing there. But you've actually been all around the personal finance space, haven't you? There's this really broad experience that I want to jump into. You've done mortgage advising, of course, property investing yourself, also experience in financial markets and foreign exchange, which is so wide. A lot of people will pick one of those. So what attracted you to the money world more broadly? Was it something where you caught the bug quite early, or you hit that point in your 20s and you were just like, this is really interesting? Where did the money world get your interest?
Yeah, good question, actually. And I think it probably goes back to sort of growing up as a kid and as a teenager and not having much money, funnily enough. Mm. So growing up in a household, my family, I had three brothers and sisters, and my parents didn't really get their shit together early on. So we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And I think when I got old enough to try and figure it out myself, I wanted to try and sort of work it out and understand what drove the property market and what drove the financial markets. And so I had this real fascination for everything to do with finance, and still do, you know, everything from investing through to property through to obviously the mortgage and property finance industry. So it sort of grabbed me early on. And I think I've also prioritized learning and experience. And in fact, I've sort of walked away from, really well-paying jobs to try something different, because I'm one of those people that, just wants to keep sort of learning and has a curious mind.
Oh, I so identify with everything you've said so far. I mean, when we talk about your property investing journey, because that you have invested a lot into residential property, haven't you? And you started quite young, which is impressive because it takes a lot of money to get started on that, or at least it can. Tell me about that. How young were you when you started to get into this?
Yeah, I had no money when I started investing in property. So, it was in my early 20s, and literally it was an opportunity came up. It was a house that was owned by my history teacher and his family, and he had brought up his family there, and he put it on the market, and I had really just started working. I'd literally just started my sort of professional career and was making, okay money, but certainly didn't have huge savings. Me and a friend got together. We pretty much put sort of $5,000 on a credit card each.
Oh my God.
To pay a deposit on the house. And we negotiated a deferred settlement. So we basically gave him $10,000, I think it was, and got a 3-month settlement. But we got to move into the house early, and during that time, we basically tidied it up and got it revalued. And by the time we settled on the property, we had increased the value by about $40,000. So that was the first property, and literally at that point, we had no real savings, no deposit. KiwiSaver wasn't really a thing back then, and because I didn't really come from money, so we didn't have, parents to really draw on or anything like that. So it was a bit of a punt. And our initial plan was that we were going to do it up and sell it and then become these big time property developers.
I love that so much. I mean, I'm still stuck on the credit card moment. That surely wouldn't be allowed now, I think.
No. This was in the early 2000s. So going back to those years, you know, getting a mortgage was a lot easier. There was no LVR restrictions. There was no, you know, obviously triple CFA rules around, you know, consumer protection rules. And we got our mortgage from a mortgage broker who funded it through a solicitor's nominee kind of account, which is basically just a private lender. So you'd probably call it a sort of dodgy loan. And we were paying really high interest. But we made it work. You know, we made it work. And when we moved in, we'd obviously already increased the value. And because, you know, we had this initial equity, you know, we could, you know, borrow a little bit more money to actually start doing the proper renovation. Now, along the way, my business partner, who was in on the property with me, actually had an accident and fractured his back. And he was actually a builder at the time. So he was supposed to be doing the work on the property. And in the end, plans changed.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because it is, I feel like for a lot of people, I mean, I'm already so hooked on that. I still can't get past the credit card thing. But I do feel like for a lot of people, when you are trying to make those initial steps to building up your wealth, it gets so much easier further down the track. But that first investment, that first step that you make is often sort of by hook or by crook, whatever the current situation is with lending or whatever. And now, did you say how old you were when this was happening?
Yeah, I was 22 when we bought the house. So literally just straight out of uni. So it was a pretty high risk venture, put it mildly. But
yeah,
going back to that period of time, you know, this was Waiheke Island. I'd grown up on Waiheke through the 90s and had seen property prices back when I was a kid. You could buy a section of Waiheke for kind of $10,000. Yeah, that same section today would be, you know, well over $1 million. So I'd seen this massive increase in property values growing up as a teenager. And because my parents had made some poor decisions financially and we didn't own a house, I think I was just really keen to get on the property ladder as soon as possible. And that was a big driver for me. And look, we ended up selling that first house. It took us a year longer than we expected. We had to borrow more money and pay higher interest and literally made nothing. So broke even, which to be fair was actually
woo.
And we learned a lot along the way. So, you know, we got some of our money back, some of the initial kind of cash that we'd put in, paid back the credit cards, paid back some of the personal loans. And I took that money and we ended up putting it into another property actually with my brother and my father. So we ended up investing in another house after that, which ended up being a long-term investment and was really successful. So, you know, I got that experience out of the way and it gave me a better appreciation for, you know, what to do and what not to do, I guess.
Well, 100%. And starting so young, but of course, as you've said yourself, you know, always looking to learn, there's always so much to learn. And there can be massive pitfalls, not least when your partner, who was supposed to be helping you out with this, fractures his back, can't do it anymore. That must have been quite terrifying. So what were sort of mistakes or pitfalls or things that happened along the way? And how did you deal with that in order to get to building to the very successful place that you are now?
Yeah, so I think it's property is a long-term game. And I think, you know, you can look at doing flips and, you know, smaller kind of projects like that. But after that first experience, you know, I've always approached property investing as a long-term game. I've also prioritized buying properties where I can add value. So I think, you know, for me, I've never really been interested in just buying something and waiting for the market to go up and making a lot of money. Obviously, the market will generate a return, and some people just prefer to have a real passive investing style. But my approach has always been trying to find something to add value. Two of the properties that I've kept over the last, you know, 20 years were both projects that I developed myself. So I did to relocatable houses, manage the projects, move the houses onto the section, did all the landscaping, project manage all the connections. And you know, it was kind of like a bit of a side hustle outside of my corporate job, which, you know, kept me kind of entertained and also created a, you know, another income stream and a bit of an entrepreneurial side hustle.
Well, yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? Because I think property, people often talk about it as if it's passive income. And it can be passive-ish depending on how you set it up. But I don't think of property as passive income. What do you think of in terms of where does it sit on that passive-active spectrum, and how should people think about it like that?
Yeah, I don't think it should be passive either. And I think you'll get much better results if you take the time to do the research yourself.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, there's a whole lot of investment property kind of coaches out there in New Zealand who help people find property and, you know, set up these sort of passive investment schemes. But I think you'd be better off doing the homework yourself. And if you do end up engaging one of those people, that's okay. I'm not completely sort of against that. But I think everyone is so sort of looking for this hyper convenience, right? And it's just like, you know, they want this full kind of turnkey investment solutions. But, you know, with investing in property, I think where you find the most value is when you can identify properties that perhaps, you know, other people can't see the value in, where there might be something that you can do to increase the value of the property. And, you know, that's for me has been probably the most satisfying part of investing in property. It's been the value add rather than just waiting for the market to kind of generate that return.
Yeah. Yeah. And you eventually got into it with your family as well there. You were saying your brother and your father, and you got a long-term investment there.
Yeah, we couldn't afford to buy a property on our own. So the three of us, after I'd exited the first project, I didn't have enough money to buy something on my own. So I ended up going in with my brother and my father. And we kept that property for many, many years. And it actually set us up for, you know, the next property and the next property. So that was another thing that I think people don't look for is the opportunity to, you know, if they can't afford to buy an owner-occupied property straight off the bat, maybe they don't have enough money initially, maybe the areas that they're looking at are not suitable or too expensive. You know, you can always look at doing, you know, something outside of your own sort of towns or districts, and doing something potentially as an investment property with someone that you trust, and you take that, you know, hopefully you grow equity in that property, and you can take that into a owner occupied or do something different with it down the track.
Well, exactly. I think there's a key phrase there that you mentioned, you know, someone that you trust. There's people I trust personally and love very much, and I wouldn't necessarily get financially entangled with them. So mixing family and money, how did that go? Do you have any tips on that front?
Yeah, I think you have to approach any investing, whether it's with friends, family, or just a business partner, with some kind of structure and agreement in terms of, you know, what everyone's obligations are, what the plan is. And write it down. It doesn't have to be a long-winded contract, but I think, you know, put something in writing so that you know what, you know, what the plan is, and ultimately have an agreement around, you know, if someone wants to move on or exit. So I think you want to have people that you can trust, obviously. You know, you're going into an investment together. There's financial obligations, there's legal obligations. So, I mean, I think you have to be really, really careful, but I think it can be a really good way to get your foot on the ladder. You know, particularly if you're in an expensive city like Auckland, where it is really hard to get that, you know, first leg up.
Yeah, exactly. And I like what you're saying there about, you know, get it written down, get a contract. Because I think sometimes people, when they're working with people they love and trust, they're like, oh, we don't need that stuff. But the thing is, you just putting it into a contract forces you to think about all sorts of different scenarios. Like you say, what if someone wants out? What if someone wants to leave the country and have a big OE over in London or whatever? I feel like everyone I know is going to London currently. You know, what if one of your partners wants to do that? Are they going to stay as just a passive investor, or do they want their money back out? You know, talking about all of these possible scenarios and getting it written down, I think is really important. Making sure that you all have something you can refer back to. You're like, oh yeah, we talked about that. What did we decide would happen there? It's so important, right? No matter how much you love and trust these people, get it written down.
100%. And I think with AI now, it's so much easier to draft up an agreement, right? You can put the high level terms in there. You can and ask the AI language model to write up an agreement. Potentially use a lawyer if you need to kind of look over it. But at the very least, have some kind of written agreement that gives you some structure. So I think that's an absolute must, regardless of how much you trust each other and how much you love each other. Ultimately, I would argue that you should probably spend more time on the agreement when you're going into something like that with friends and family, because you've got this really important relationship to protect.
Oh my God, I so agree. It is even more important when it's someone you care about, because the last thing you want is money to come into a relationship like that and wreck it. And it's so common. My God, just if you have any lawyer friends, talk to them, they'll have a horror story or five. It's so common. So yeah, absolutely. Now, as we mentioned at the top, you're now a mortgage advisor and you worked with some big companies before going out on your own. Now, I can say from experience, mortgage content, big on social media. People love talking about mortgages. They love getting tips and tricks. They love ways they can get mortgage-free earlier. Love that for everyone. But I imagine you must see the same thing I do, where you see some things around on socials that make you cringe and you think, oh God, no, don't do that. Is there anything that comes to mind where you'd like to myth bust right now?
Absolutely. And I think that the worst clickbait that I see in social media, particularly from mortgage advisors, is that you can pay your mortgage off in 5 years and save hundreds of thousands of dollars by using a different mortgage structure, which, is absolute rubbish. The reality is the only way you pay your mortgage off quicker is by spending less and paying more off your mortgage. The mortgage structure, you need to have an efficient mortgage structure, and you need to, look at that structure on a regular basis in terms of how it's set up, what your mortgage term is. But you're not going to halve your mortgage term by changing your mortgage structure. You're only going to halve your mortgage term if you sacrifice spending, and pay more off your mortgage. So a really, really cringy kind of clickbait out there in the world of social media. There's no truth to some of that.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? I think we're all guilty of looking for a silver bullet magic solution, because a mortgage is huge and scary. And I still remember when I bought my first home and I suddenly saw hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt appear. And while I was extremely excited to have my first home, don't get me wrong, seeing that number turn up at the bottom of my bank account was mildly terrifying. And so I totally get why people are looking for a magic solution. There are wonderful ways that you can structure your mortgage, like you say, that help. But at the end of the day, the biggest thing, right, is find some extra money to put onto the mortgage in any extra way that you can. And that does save you lots in fees and interest, and you'll get further faster than you think, but you're going to have to make little sacrifice to get big reward.
Exactly. And look, there are some smart ways to structure your mortgage to make some incremental savings and gains, but it is going to come with a sacrifice of spending less and either saving more or paying more off your mortgage. I think ultimately a good mortgage advisor can add a lot of value in terms of looking at the structure, but I think some of the clickbait around paying your mortgage off in 5 years or saving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars off your mortgage without changing your repayments is rubbish.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you have a favorite structure in terms of making those repayments easier? I know some people like things like the revolving in order to make it easier to get those extra payments in. So do you have a favorite structure, something that works for, nothing works for 100% of people, but But is there something that works for maybe 80% of people?
Yeah, look, I think having a small revolving credit where you've got your income, all of your income going into to offset the principal on that particular account. So with a revolving credit, you can redraw against the facility. So it's effectively like a big overdraft, which is secured against your mortgage. Where I think some people get that product wrong is that they have this massive revolving credit and all their money goes into it, and they just start to lose kind of touch with, you know, what their income and expenses are. So I think you do have to be disciplined around it. But if it's only a small revolving credit and you're using it to kind of pay down the balance as quickly as possible and then restructuring your mortgage into a a fixed term loan, then I think it can be really powerful. I also think that the revolving credit or an offset.
Sorry, what counts as a small revolving credit?
Oh, like $20,000, you know, like just for the average person who is using their revolving credit as an instrument to pay down that balance quicker by having all of their income sitting in the revolving credit, offsetting the limit during that period, and maybe using other, you know, maybe using their credit cards to pay for other standard bills and then paying off the credit cards in full from the revolving credit. Because the idea is that you want more money sitting in your revolving credit, reducing the limit.
Yeah, nice. I'll tell you one myth I see all the time on social media. I'd love to know if people ask you about it and what you think about it. I see all the time people saying, pay your mortgage weekly instead of monthly, and then you'll save all of this money on interest. Is there any truth to that?
No, it's marginal. I mean, ultimately, the repayments that you're making on your mortgage, right? So when you have a loan term of, say, 20 years, the repayments are structured in a way that the bank has forecast that you're going to make so many payments over that 20-year period. Regardless of whether you're making those payments fortnightly or monthly, the loan structure in terms of the principal and interest being paid is already predetermined. So it makes a very, very small difference if you're paying fortnightly versus monthly, pretty much negligible. And the only difference is that you might be making a couple more payments every year if you're paying fortnightly. So I think there's no real sort of magic bullet by using fortnightly over monthly. The only difference is that you're paying more repayments in a 12-month period when you're paying fortnightly versus monthly.
Okay, I'm so relieved to hear you say that, because that is something I had heard from other people as well. And I wanted to run it by you because, yeah, that is what I'd heard. You see this all the time on social media of, you know, pay it more often and it'll save you interest. And I was just like, that doesn't feel right. That it's not passing the sniff test, you know? And yet when I'd looked at it, I was like, maybe it's making you accidentally make an extra payment, and that's how they're crunching some of these numbers differently. So there you go. That's exactly what you landed on without me even prompting you on it. Isn't it nice to have your own thoughts reinforced by an expert?
You were thinking the right way. So it's just all about the extra repayment rather than actually reducing the principal and therefore reducing the overall loan term.
And when we talk about it, this is funny because this came up with a friend. I love my friends. They'll often follow me, but they're my friends. They're following me to support me, not because they're actual people who listen to this podcast and give a damn. So they're sort of like, yay, saw that you posted and I'll mention something about it. And then I can really tell they didn't watch the video. I love them so much. And I had a friend who saw me post something about making extra payments on your mortgage and how I'd just upped payments by $20 a week. And it had knocked years off the mortgage. It was absolutely wild to me. And so we got talking about it and she was like, what do you mean $20 a week actually worked? And it ran her through it. I think the average person, this is a surprise to them, how far ahead you can get with relatively small extra payments. Why is that so powerful? It's knocking off all of the other money that would have come with it, right? Like a dollar extra on your mortgage isn't just a dollar extra on your mortgage, is it?
Yeah, it's the reverse power of compounding interest. So if you're knocking off that that dollar, you're having a big impact on the interest that you're paying over the life of the loan because you're reducing that principal amount. Which, you know, it's and you can play around with the calculators. I mean, most lenders allow you to make extra repayments on your mortgage throughout the even through a fixed term period without any penalties. So again, I would recommend if you've got, you know, surplus money coming in, you can make additional repayments on your mortgage, reduce their principal balance as quickly as possible, play around with the numbers and get the satisfaction of, you know, how much you're saving by looking at the long term. You guys, because the calculators are relatively easy to use, and you can, you know, put the repayment in and it shows you how much you're saving. So
yeah, I love it. Literally Google mortgage calculator, put in how much you're currently paying, up it by, I don't know, $20, $40, $50, whatever you can spare in a week. We've all got different budgets. See how much that will knock off. Because none of us are good at the maths. It's these calculators that's right there and makes it easy for you. And you can see suddenly how much time that'll knock off, how much faster you'll get ahead, because the extra money you put on goes straight onto the amount you were loaned in the first place. It's not all the interest. It's not all the fees that come with it. It's knocking off that amount that you were loaned in the very first place. And therefore, it's also knocking off everything that money would have cost you, all of the interest, all of the fees. It can be worth double, sometimes three times as much. It's wild how big an impact it can make.
Yeah, 100%. So I think, getting used to playing around with the calculators and figuring out if you can make extra repayments, again, is super, super powerful.
Yeah. Okay. Total gear change here. You were also with XE.com.
Mm-hmm.
Huge foreign exchange company. So tell me about your time there. What were you doing? What did you learn?
Yeah. So I started with what was originally called HighFX and then got rebranded to XE.com. I started in the private client dealing team. So I used to look after people, mostly private clients and consumers moving money around the world. And then I moved into the corporate FX team. So working with companies, managing foreign exchange risk, so hedging foreign exchange risk. And for a period of time, I had a group of investors that I worked with as well. So high net worth investors that were moving money around the world, hedging currency risk, but then some of them were also trading foreign exchange. So actually taking Forex positions to try and make a profit. So really, really interesting, interesting market. You know, foreign exchange is still the world's largest market. It's trillions of dollars is traded every week. And it's pretty much 24 hours a day all the way through to Saturday morning, New Zealand time. So, it's a really fascinating market and tends to move quicker than every other market in the world. So, you know, you've got obviously equity markets and commodity markets, interest rate markets. If something happens in the world, the Forex market is the first market to react because it's the deepest, most liquid and traded market in the world. So it's a really fascinating market to trade in and participate in. And if you're an information junkie and you enjoy volatility and uncertainty, it can be a bit of a buzz.
Yeah, I definitely think it's one of those. Forex trading has a real mystique about it, I think. Gets a lot of people's interest because there's so much money involved. And yet there's snakes and there's sharks in the water. Do you think the average person can get into it?
Look, I think if you look at the stats, I think about 97% of people who try and trade foreign exchange lose money or, you know, don't make money. So the reality is a lot of the retail foreign exchange propositions out there, and, you know, if you've ever sort of jumped onto some of these companies' websites, you know, there's trading companies that offer the ability to put down a small deposit. You know, you could put down, say, a $5,000 deposit and get leverage of 100 to 1. So suddenly $5,000 and you're trading, you know, $100,000 plus positions. So really easy to kind of get set up with one of these companies and start trading big positions, which means, you know, really quick and easy to lose money, because when you're using that kind of leverage, it doesn't take a big move in the market to wipe you out. I think it's one of those, I guess, industries that attracts people because it's kind of got that get rich quick vibe to it. You know, it's like, you know, you can trade foreign exchange and become a millionaire with, you know, with a very small amount of upfront capital. Well, you know, that's the promise at least. But the reality is, you know, even the most experienced traders in the world that is, you know, living and breathing it are working in the, you know, the financial market dealing rooms of the big investment banks and hedge funds and trading houses in New York and London and Hong Kong and Singapore and the like. Very few of them are winning all the time. You know, it's a really difficult market to make a profit in.
And you have to be so fast. I mean, there's some interesting stories that you see around the place, and obviously I keep an eye on headlines and how things go. And I have read some interesting profiles about the people who trade for a living as professionals on this. And it, just down to the little things, like they're all based in New York because we are talking fractions of a second in which they want to do these trades. Literally, if you're trying to do this from LA, your internet connection to the main trading sites in New York will mean it's too slow to get the trades that you want to need to get. And, you know, we're living in the fiber age here. It's not that they're trying to do this on dial-up. It's so fast. It's so specialized. It's so technical. I don't see how the average person with a job stands a chance.
No, exactly. And look, I've dabbled in trading myself, obviously working with XE.com over the years. And I actually spent a period of time working for one of the big banks in their financial markets dealing team as well. And my role there was really about helping businesses and individuals manage currency risk, because currency is just a function of trading internationally, or if you're, you know, moving money around the world for personal reasons. So really my focus was always around managing currency risk and looking at, you know, different time frames and different risk management solutions. But on the trading side, there's people that are, you know, naturally attracted to it. I think it's kind of similar to gambling, really. You know, like if you sort of line it up with making a bet on the direction of the market, you know, ultimately there's a 50-50 chance you're going to get it right. If perhaps you've got a slight edge, or you've got the risk appetite to hold a position and trade through it, then, you know, sometimes you can win. But more often than not, over the long run, you'll lose. So it's certainly not something that I would recommend for anyone who's trying to build long-term sustainable wealth. And in fact, I've seen a lot of people that have, you know, sold businesses and suddenly have come across millions of dollars and they've decided that they want to become professional traders, you know, lose a lot of money in the making. You know, it's not something that I would be sort of recommending.
Absolutely. It is. It's a good wealth buster instead of builder, isn't it?
Yeah. Totally. So, the reality is, you know, for some people trading internationally, a lot of New Zealand companies are exposed to currency risk. It's a lot of importers, a lot of exporters that are, you know, buying and selling currency for business purposes. And so they need to navigate that. And that's where good risk management solutions and different hedging and derivatives come into effect.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, right? Because we've talked about full-blown Forex trading so far, right? But that's one end of the scale, and then not touching it at all is the other end of the scale. Huge gray zone in the middle, where if anyone who's listening to this, a lot of people who listen to this podcast will be people who are interested in investing. They might have bought shares, say they've bought into something from BlackRock or Vanguard or whoever. Those are in US dollars. So you will have changed your money to US dollars to invest in that. Well, technically, you've just done a bit of Forex trading. And like you say, companies, if they're importing, exporting, you might be selling in another currency, trying to convert it back to, say, New Zealand dollars if you're headquartered back here. So there's all sorts of various reasons why you might still have a bit of Forex trading just as you move through the world, especially moving through the money world. So are there any little tips and tricks to help with that, if you are in that gray zone of just moving through our big old global world, What tips and tricks people should know about on those fronts?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're moving money around the world, the exchange rates that you're being offered by any given provider, if it's a bank or a foreign exchange specialist, typically include a margin. So there'll be a margin built into the exchange rate. And what a lot of people don't realize, particularly with the big banks offshore in North America, UK, Europe, Australia, and even New Zealand, retail foreign exchange margins can be up to 4 or 5%. So effectively, you're getting a 4% margin built into the exchange rate being charged by the retail trading bank for making for transacting in that foreign currency. New Zealand banks are more competitive than some of the UK and North American banks, but you imagine you're moving $100,000 from the UK back to New Zealand. There could be a 4% margin built into the exchange rate that you can't see. Obviously, there's, you know, you can Google what the actual wholesale exchange rate is now, but still a lot of people don't realize there's alternative ways of moving money around the world. And there's obviously a lot of fintechs now operating in that space, Exi.com, who I worked for. And there's a number of really good specialists that provide a more competitive exchange rate and also dedicated support and advice. So you can actually speak to someone who knows what they're doing. They're doing it, you know, all day long. That's their profession. And I think they add a lot of value. So I think research different options, find a really good provider, and compare the rate, and don't rely on, you know, just taking the bank rate. You know, it's usually not going to be the best rate. And you're usually not going to be able to speak to anyone about what's going on in the market and different options to potentially, you know, hedge your currency risk and take advantage of some solutions that could really add value and provide a lot more certainty. So definitely do your research. And again, taking the time to educate yourself and being more informed.
Yeah, 100%. Now, look, I don't want to waste time before we get to this, but you've also got this amazing business that you've started. And I want to give us enough time to talk about that properly because you've started your own business. How exciting. Tell me about it and why you decided to go out on your own after all of these amazing travails through various companies. Now you're on your own. Why?
Yeah, so I started Colab Mortgages about 2 months ago with another business partner. We are both at a similar age and stage. We've worked for big banks and big corporates and spent a lot of time, making other people a lot of money and shareholders a lot of money, and realized that we can probably do it for ourselves. But probably more than that, I think it's about, you know, being able to operate with your own kind of set of values and the way you want to manage your clients and relationships, and you get to you get to set your own path. And I think, you know, for me, I certainly just got to the point where, you know, I wanted to be in control of my values, you know, particularly in a work setting, you know, and build something for the long term. So, you know, I've got a real strong client first mentality, really focused on trying to do the right thing, you know, just being on the client side, because I think the world of finance, you know, and the big financial institutions and the big product providers out there, most consumers are coming into these transactions and it's not a level playing field. These big product providers and financial institutions have so much more information and knowledge and power than the average consumer. So the role of a financial advisor for me is that trusted advisor that's on the client's side. So I'm not working for the financial institutions. You know, I'm working for my clients. So that position, that kind of role, I guess, is something that that I take really seriously, and I feel like I can add a lot of value with all my experience and insights that I've gathered over the years.
Yeah, I love that. I so identify with what you're saying. When you go independent and you can finally manage things just the way you want to, you're speaking my language there. What do you do at Colab Mortgages? Tell me a bit about the business. You know, you say that you want to even things out a bit and make things easier for the average person who's at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of the knowledge they might have and the strategies that might be available to them. So tell me about this business and how you've set it up to achieve those sorts of things.
Yeah. So at this point, it's myself and another business partner, and we'll be looking to grow the team next year. We're focused on mortgages and property finance, and it's a full service mortgage brokerage. But between my business partner and myself, we've both done a lot of property investing, a lot of property development, renovations. You know, between us, we've bought and sold more than 20 houses. And we've done everything from small renos to big renos to building townhouses to doing relocatables to, you know, subdivisions. And so I guess, you know, we've got this really strong banking and finance backgrounds. You know, we understand what's happening in the world of mortgages and interest rates and non-bank lending. But then we've got this real passion for property and really helping people navigate home buying journey, whether it's your first home or an upgrade. Or an investment property transaction where, you know, you're just starting out. You've got no idea, and you're maybe talking to a bunch of different people that have ulterior motives around selling you something that, you know, is maybe going to generate them a big commission. You know, so we want to come into this, come into these transactions and bring more transparency and add value through the kind of process of you know, giving advice and giving people more insight into the market and their decision making.
Isn't it interesting what you're saying there with the background of yourself as a property investor, as well as, you know, the work history of the financials? And I was talking to someone about this the other day in terms of, again, nothing applies to everyone 100%, but I have a quite strong feeling that for many people, your 20s isn't necessarily about finding the dream career. It's about bouncing around, trying a lot of things, building up a lot of skills. And then you often end up hitting 30s, 40s, whatever, and you combine all of these things from inside and outside work. And it's when you're combining skills from a few different areas, more valuable and more niche, because then you can look at it and say, yes, I know all the technicalities of a mortgage. I also understand the property investing journey, especially if you're doing X, Y, and Z, because I did that. And let me tell you what you should not do right now, you know? And it's, I think if you just bounce around and you try a bunch of stuff in your 20s, the income you can chase, the businesses you can build, whatever, later on, 30s and 40s, I feel like combining those skills is the way to create a higher value proposition. Is that where you've sort of landed as well with your business journey now?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think all my experience and learning, and I think as I've mentioned before, I've always had this real curiosity, right? This sort of wanting to kind of keep learning and then combining, you know, this really kind of relevant experience in financial markets, which is, you know, you're navigating the world of foreign exchange and interest rates every day, looking at what's happening in the, you know, the economic world and the political world. And trying to sort of trying to kind of give your clients a little bit of an edge in terms of how they're navigating that, and then into the world of obviously property investing and property development, and then my, you know, more recent career as a mortgage advisor, and being able to structure the lending or find the right lending for people's different circumstances. So it's a, for me, it feels like, you know, I've been building up to this for, you know, the last 20 years of my career. And so it feels really satisfying to get to the point where you go, actually, well, I actually do know quite a lot. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I'm not just, you know, sort of coming into this, putting, you know, this kind of badge on me saying, hey, now I know how to be a financial advisor. You know, I feel like I've really earned the right to kind of to be in this role and start this company. And it's sort of taken me a long time to get to this point. And I probably wanted to do it earlier, but I didn't feel like, you know, I had earned the right. And so for me and for my business partner, who's very similar, we're both feeling really kind of excited about taking our experience and knowledge and sharing that with the world.
I love that. That's so brilliant. And you're spot on in terms of that feeling of, it's very satisfying, isn't it? When you land on something and you're building a business and you're like, there's no imposter syndrome anymore. You're just like, no, actually, I do have the background. You know, I am actually pretty good at this and I can help people here. It's a really nice feeling, isn't it?
100%. I think, you know, throughout my career, you know, I certainly had imposter syndrome, particularly when I first started in the world of financial markets. But nowadays, I definitely think I've earned my stripes. And yeah, it's quite satisfying to be able to combine, you know, combine all of that experience. And because I've got this natural curiosity for it, it's, you know, all of the reading that I do, all the podcasts I listen to, all of the books that I read, I mean, it's just a natural interest that I have. And I guess, you know, I'm constantly trying to sort of give myself an edge, and now I get to share that with other people. So that's a really satisfying place to be and set myself up through the business for the long term, you know, having something to build over the long run, being able to be really clear about your values and the people that you work with. And I think that's another big thing about, you know, being in a small business and having that kind of control over things is that you can be very clear about the people that you work with and spend time with. And I think that's also a really rewarding element to it.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Well, if people want to find you and your new business, where can they find you?
So dan@colab.kiwi is my email address. I'm also on LinkedIn, just Dan Bell. Always keen for a chat. Looking forward to reaching out and talking to different people.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time and talking us through all the tips and tricks from your various places you've been through the money world. What a wonderful, varied career you've had. That's Dan Bell from Colab Mortgages. Now, if you have a question for me on this or anything else to do with money, do get in touch. Francis Cook NZ, pretty much everywhere. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, also heaps more money content on there for you. And there's also my newsletter, The Money Memo, for a free money tip in your inbox every week. That's linked in the show notes. It is also on my website, francescook.co.nz. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.